This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hszc.org.
I think on a number of occasions, Suzuki Roshi reminded us that we should be prepared to carry out our practice under all circumstances. And one way to become acquainted with what that means is to practice our sitting under a variety of circumstances. And to do so incorporates the practice of non-attachment to this body, this body-mind, which of course is, from the Buddhist point of view, significant. Lately, I don't think I have been setting such a good example. Nowadays, quite a few years of practice under my belt if I'm not feeling particularly well, I sometimes won't go to the Zendo. And in fact, I usually recommend to people, if they're ill, that they rest up. And this is to prevent our practice from developing a quality of an extreme sport. And some people treat it that way, which I don't think that's what Buddha had in mind. Still, Buddha also recognized the challenge of our attachment to ourselves. And among the many misconceptions of Buddhism that are floating around is this notion that if you're a successful practitioner, you will have somehow gotten rid of your person. And sometimes in the, would say, maybe slightly cynically, in the process of projection that goes on in so-called spiritual circles, sometimes you'll hear people say of such and such a teacher, he or she doesn't have any ego anymore. Usually, if I hear that, I feel like running the other way very fast. As we've said any number of times, you can't function in this world without a, quote, ego, or without a person. So the actual challenge then is not getting rid of the person, but coming to understand what the person actually is. And you might wonder, how could sitting still in an underheated room, how could that bring to light what the person is? Well, in addition to sitting still, which, as I've said many times, is already a challenge to the notion of an established self. So just that much, just being still deliberately, is a challenge to the karma of the apparent sentient being. If in addition we bring a quality of attention to that stillness, then that's even more of a challenge to the conventional settled understanding that I'm here and you're over there, and never the twain shall meet. And unfortunately, when the, to use an archaic model, when the bodily humors are out of whack, it's interesting, but usually our attachment gets more intense. The more precarious we feel, the more try to find something to hang on to, which is perfectly understandable. So the notion that there is something to be hung on to is the linchpin of all suffering. So if we are to at least mitigate our suffering and the suffering of others, if not indeed banish it altogether, it's necessary to see what the nature of this is. At first, if we're fortunate enough to hear Buddha's teaching, it starts off as something heard, basically. It starts off as something heard. And in a sense, of course, the teaching is taken in through the ears and the eyes and so forth. But in its true sense, the teaching is comes from us, comes from our own heart. I have a great fondness for the teachings of Carl Jung and his followers, And so there's a Facebook page where somebody frequently puts up quotations from Jung, and he was, in this quote, he was saying something like, we have our, you know, in the West, the Western cultural sphere, we have these Ten Commandments. And for most people, he says, they remain a list that has been memorized. That was not the intention. The intention was that those, if you like, commandments are to be heard by each person as God's voice. In other words, not coming from outside, but from inside. It's very interesting to hear Jung talk about God, and it rapidly becomes clear that he's not talking about God the way most people talk about God in the West. He's referring to the divine voice within us. And to clarify that voice in the midst of all the other stuff that's constantly churning, there's usually some work involved. And for us Buddhists, if that's what we are, there's a very similar process. We, of course, at least in this lineage, we have 16 bodhisattva precepts. And certainly the case for me that when I encountered them initially, it was a list, and I memorized the list. And it took quite a while to come to appreciate that the list is some things that Buddha, not said, but is saying, that some people heard. So when we have a ceremony of granting precepts, for instance, we present the I don't know if preceptee is a word, but anyway, we present the preceptee with a kind of a robe thing that you see some people wear. And members of the clergy have to wear more of a robe for some reason. And during that ceremony, we recite together, or in kind of antiphonal style, the so-called preceptor speaks of the precepts and the preceptee repeats So that ceremony is actually simply meant to remind the person receiving precepts and everyone else that we need to realize that those precepts are Buddha speaking in us. Otherwise, as Jung said, you wander around with a head full of lists that you memorized. So what the hell? How useful is that? It's like, well, I suppose you could memorize all of the parking regulations in San Francisco, but to what end? So, this being still and attentive, sort of becomes a theater of Buddha speaking. Buddha speaks of a great number of things in addition to what's a good way to be in the world. Buddha also speaks of who it is that walks in the world. So while pretty much all of us need to begin by allowing the teaching to enter through the ears, through the miracle of practice, teaching comes back out of our own heart, where it always was to begin with. So, Jung was also very distrustful of people who feel that they have a reference manual for how to be in the world, and you just find the right page, you can always clarify things. No, said Jung, that is actually quite dangerous. And it is necessary for all humankind to be able to hear God's voice or Buddha's voice or something from inside. So our stories in the Chan lineage in a way are always trying to turn us away from conventional understanding. And hopefully, what the word is, orienting us or something in a space where the still small voice is in fact audible. So these strange and paradoxical stories are kind of the equivalent of someone coming up and grabbing us and spinning us in a circle until we're totally dizzy and we don't know left from right. And in that fruitful state, if we've learned how to listen, something miraculous can happen. After a while, though, once we had accumulated quite a few of these stories, they became an end in themselves. And their use became a kind of an occasion for a sort of literary competition. So then you wound up, there are stories about trying to loosen our attachment to stories. The other day, we had a guest speaker, and this person brought up a story. Some of you were here, maybe. It's from the Book of Serenity. Features the great master Yangshan. Often these stories start out innocently. So Yangshan asks somebody, "Where are you from?" Person, probably one of his monastics, replies, "Oh, I'm from such and such a province." And Yangshan says, "So, do you think about that place a lot?" And the monastic says, "Yes, I think about it all the time." So if you're kind of familiar with these stories, you can see that the monastic is already on to Yangshan's game a little bit. So Yangshan decides to tease him a little more, and he says, "Well, you know, what we call mind is like the environment. in there are walls and tiles and pebbles and automobiles and unibuses and birds and bees and so on. Now, what if you reflect on the mind itself? Are there so many things in it? And the monastic, again, playing along with Yongshan's game, says, well, actually, when I get there, I don't see anything existing at all. And I think he's expecting a pat on the head from Yongshan, but he doesn't get one. Yongshan just snorts and says, well, I guess that's all right for the stage of faith, but not for the stage of person. So you can wear the robe and take your seat, but hereafter, you better see for yourself. Now, ordinarily for a Buddhist, to be able to say, man, I don't see anything existing at all, implies a sort of developed samadhi. And that's okay. Yongshan, by the way, as you know, is a disciple of the great Guishan, Lingyo, and one night Yongshan was out in front of the monk's hall sitting. And at some point, it was as though there was nothing but empty space everywhere. So the next day he went and told his teacher, Guishan, about this, and Guishan thought, yeah, that's pretty good. But as one of our favorite poems says, what does it say? According with sameness is still not awakening. So the stage of faith, so to speak, it's like receiving the list and memorizing it and thinking, okay, great, now I have memorized the list. But the stage of person is when the list speaks from your own heart. Now, Buddhism is, as you may know, there are many, many dozens of lists. But just like referring to, for instance, the Bible as some sort of owner's manual is dangerous. It's also dangerous to take out your book of Buddhist lists and look for solutions there. our great ancestor Dogen evoking the body, the body-mind of practice, said, mountains, rivers, the great wide earth, the sun, moon, and stars. And when you get there, you may see nothing at all. And that nothing is exactly mountains, rivers, the great wide earth, the sun, moon, and stars. So maybe this morning you were willing to let the teaching turn you in circles a little bit and make you a little dizzy. And sometimes when we're dizzy, we have to sit down. And sometimes when we're sitting down, the voice of stillness instructs us. Would you like to ask some questions?
I want to clarify something. I mean, I know that, thank you for your talk, and it went various directions, but we're still back in the first opening about the, I appreciate the, you know, the compassion if one's sick, but you know, I've also had other teachers in Sesshin say, you know, if you're sick, sit, you know, this sort of, I don't think it's necessarily like one way is soft and one way is extreme squat, but there could be a middle way when you wake up and think, okay, I feel a little sick, but okay, I can get to the Zendo, or I'm a little tired, and I just wanted to express that, but I sort of, I'm part of my Zen training, appreciate that, because I think,
yeah.
Do you agree with that?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Oh, okay.
And when I was younger, I used, you know, that was just how you did it.
Yeah.
And so I'm a little embarrassed that I don't necessarily approach it quite that way anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say, yeah, do that a little bit and
mm-hmm.
see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
See how it is.
Okay.
And it's better to do that maybe when you're not so old, because you get to be my age. One can often find oneself wondering, why the hell am I doing this? I should be in bed. And that's actually okay. So, but it is good to try it a bit and see what happens.
Yeah. Well, especially on a retreat, I think, too, if you have, like, I'm not saying, like, if you have a massive headache, but, like, if you have, like, a little cold and you sit, sometimes it's okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, just to sit with that.
Yes, and as Suzuki said, if you know when you're sitting under those circumstances, your experience of your body mind will be different.
Yeah.
So it's fine. It's best to sit when you're well. And if you also sometimes experiment with, okay, I'm not so well, let's see how this goes. That's another set of circumstances which will acquaint us with the body's true voice.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So, yeah, I agree. You're just a young fellow, though. Yes.
You talked about how Jung is suspicious of people trying to look into some kind of a reference manual for the answer. That makes a lot of sense to me. But at the same time, I wonder, it seems also that there's a certain amount of work you can do just on yourself. Like if you're troubled with something, just by really earnestly trying to understand it and sort it out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you think that I mean, that seems different than looking for an answer in some kind of reference book, but it seems like it can, as long as you don't overdo it, could be fruitful to try to work towards some kind of clarity, not just
speaking of old age. One way that to understand what you're talking about is maybe there's the practice in Western monasticism called Lectio Divina. Have you heard of that? So you have the Bible or the scriptures, and you open it pretty much at random, and you start to read, but you read very slowly. You savor every word. You're not looking for anything in particular. It's like you're praying the book, and in that sense, it's coming from you. So that sort of approach to the manual, if you like, is very different from like hunting through it for some explanation or justification, which of course it has been used for many, many times, usually with disastrous results. Yeah,
go ahead. I wasn't thinking so much as looking towards outside sources as looking at your own experience and trying to come to terms with what is going wrong and trying to understand that through observation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You found this helpful?
It can be very helpful, but it seems like there's only a certain point that you can start going around in circles with that.
Right. And for me, at that point, I try and bring someone else into the conversation, because that can be useful too. Yes.
In the early part of your talk, you were talking about, let's say, the voice of God as opposed to this inner voice, or whatever, however it is you would like to refer to it. And for some reason, it reminded me of a short story I read recently by Philip K. Dick, and anyone who is familiar with him at all knows that he was somewhat mad. I mean, certifiably somewhat mad.
He was a little nuts.
Perhaps even schizophrenic. And in this particular story, it's very, very evident, because he starts conflating all sorts of things with other things that don't necessarily bear any relationship to one another.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, within that, there's the seed of the voice that's speaking from within.
Mm-hmm.
But the voice speaks, and then he starts spinning off into all kinds of mad directions. Mm-hmm. And when I was thinking about that, I thought, well, that seems to be like when you start having, like, prophets speaking the word.
Mm.
And it's like, oh, my God. Time to be wary, I think.
Yeah. Well, one thing that seems to be clear from not just the Western tradition, but maybe any tradition that has a prophetic theme, the prophets almost invariably have a terrible time. And when they are, you know, giving voice to what they were told to give voice to, usually bad things happen to them. People beat them up or try to kill them or chase them out of town.
That's all my way.
Yes. Prophecy, I think Jung would say, a prophecy that is genuine will provoke some reaction from people. I don't remember which prophet it was in the Western scripture. One of the prophets was told, okay, go to the city wall and take a sledgehammer and knock a big hole in it. And then take all your stuff and throw it outside into the desert. And that was the instruction. And along with that, there were some words that the person's fellow townspeople did not appreciate about, you know, okay, great, you got a nice, comfortable life for yourself here. Have you forgotten what actually matters? So I think, and of course, the famous Ezekiel, I believe, got chased right out of town. He had to go hide in a cave because people were going to kill him because they didn't like the message. So one of the characteristics of prophecy is it strikes people as genuine, and it makes them mad, usually, as a result.
It makes people angry,
yes.
Because it strikes them as genuine?
Well, yes, because there's a critique in there. Okay. And the reason that there are prophets is to remind us that, hey, maybe that isn't exactly what was intended. You know? Larry, did you want to say something?
Oh, I was wondering. It seems to me that, you know, as you practice over years, you know, you'll lose your job, or your leg will hurt, or you'll run out of money, or you get sick. So inevitably, you will be practicing, you know, under different circumstances, and it will feel different.
Yes.
And it is very attractive to have the notion that voice mm-hmm. Will somehow continue as a continuous recollection that isn't going to change, and I wonder mm-hmm. if that's maybe not the best way to hope for.
Well, in a sense, one of the characteristics of the voice, and we're already getting into trouble here, I can tell, using that word, it's actually enormously consistent. And if it starts, you know, suddenly you think you're getting totally the opposite message or something, there may be something a little bit askew there. Because usually, you know, Buddha is pretty straightforwardly always saying the same stuff. And same with, you know, God, if you want to use that frame of reference. Now, I think we're past the point where, I hope, God says, yeah, all those people in the next valley, you should kill them all. Because that was, you know, those stories always made me wonder whether somebody had gotten something a little wrong there. As far as I know, Buddha never suggested that, oh yeah, we should go kill those people. And overall, the still small voice, the voice of our true heart, doesn't invite us to injure others. So, if at some point we think we're getting the message that we should injure others, we should probably ask for some assistance. Yes. Alas. Yeah. Anyway, I don't mean to keep you all too long. Footnote, but something like that, to all this is, at some point you need to trust that voice. And that's not always easy. Thank you very much.